Today's April 18th. It's our first class after the Pesach break. And this morning we're studying the third unit in this Milton Scholars curriculum on the beginning of the book of Exodus. The subject is the burning bush. I'm not sure what page it turns out in the workbook you have, unit 3. In what I have in front of me, it's page 98, but it's probably not the same in your pages.
47.
So as usual, we'll begin by reading the text once through in English, and then we'll go back through it verse by verse and even word by word to try and delve into it more thoroughly and deeply. So I'm going to read from Shmot, Exodus, chapter 3, verses 1 to 22. And before I read, let's just remember the background. Moses, fled as a young man from Egypt, where he had grown up in the palace of Paro. We know that he had lived with his mother and father only until he was weaned, right? Only until he was a very young infant. So it's hard to ascertain how much connection he had really with his parents and with their heritage. If from the age of 2 to the age of 15 or 20 he grew up in Paro's palace, the question is always going to be, what degree of Jewish identity did he have? What degree of Jewish knowledge? What degree of a sense of connection to the fate of the Israelite slaves? We don't know the answers to those questions, and it can certainly be that he had very little connection. We read last time that when he was a young man, after growing up in the palace of Paro, he went out to see his brethren, and he did certain acts that sure showed a certain degree of connection and identification, but how deep that connection and identification went, we just don't know. And then he flees to Midian, right? He flees to Midian after hearing that there's a price on his head for killing the Egyptian taskmaster, and it looks like he was there in Midian for about 60 years. If he was 15 or 20 when he fled to Midian, and there are verses that say he began his shlichut, he began his work for God at the age of 80, that means that 60 years passed since he's been in Egypt, and something like 78 years have passed since he had real time with his family. That's a long, long time. And that means that he's been a Midianite shepherd for decades upon decades, 60 years, when we come to this point in his life when God meets him at the burning bush. That's the background. Here we read. Shmot, Exodus chapter 3 from the beginning. I'm reading from the translation as it's printed in our book, our syllabus. Now Moshe, tending the flock of his father-in-law Yitro, the priest of Midian, drove the flock into the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. That's the same mountain, later called Sinai, the same mountain. An angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire out of a bush. He gazed, and there was a bush all aflame, yet the bush was not consumed. Moshe said, I must turn aside to look at this marvelous sight. Why doesn't the bush burn up? When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to look, God called to him out of the bush, Moshe, Moshe. He answered, Hineni, here I am. And he said, do not come closer. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you stand is holy ground. I am, he said, the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. And the Lord continued, I have marked well the plight of my people in Egypt, and have heeded their outcry because of their taskmasters. Yes, I am mindful of their sufferings. I have come down to rescue them from the Egyptians and to bring them out of that land to a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the region of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Now the cry of the Israelites has reached me. Moreover, I have seen how the Egyptians oppress them. Come, therefore, I will send you to Paro, and you shall free my people, the Israelites, from Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Paro and free the Israelites from Egypt? And he said, I will be with you. That shall be your sign that it was I who sent you. And when you have freed the people from Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. Moses said to God, when I come to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, Eheyeh Asher Eheyeh, literally meaning, I am what I am, or I will be what I will be. He continued, thus shall you say to the Israelites, Eheyeh sent me to you. Literally, I will be sent me to you. And God said further to Moses, thus shall you speak to the Israelites. The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This shall be my name forever, this my appellation for all eternity. Go and assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob has appeared to me and said, I have taken note of you and what is being done to you in Egypt. And I have declared, I will take you out of the misery of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, to a land flowing with milk and honey. They will listen to you. Then you shall go with the elders of Israel to the king of Egypt and say to them, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, manifested himself to us. Now therefore let us go a distance of 3 days into the wilderness to sacrifice to the Lord our God. Yet I know that the king of Egypt will let you go only because of a greater might. So I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with various wonders which I will work upon them. After that he shall let you go. I will dispose of the Egyptians favorably towards this people, so that when you go, you will not go away empty-handed. Each woman shall borrow from her neighbor and the larger in her house objects of silver and gold and clothing. You shall put these on your sons and daughters, thus stripping the Egyptians. Let's go back and read again, slowly, word by word. Okay, so now I'm reading again. Now Moshe, tending the flock of his father-in-law, Yitro, the priest of Midian, drove the flock into the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. So what do you ask? What would you ask? What might bother you, if anything, in this verse? What needs elucidation? Is there any extra information?
How far away was this?
Okay, how far away?
How long did it take him? Did he just hang out there forever and just wander on with the flock?
Well, right, how far away?
Did he come in on a daily basis after he tended the flock? Did he sleep there? Where was anybody?
Okay. In relationship to that, what Miriam just said, I want to see the Hebrew, the original Hebrew, for a short part of what we just read from verse 1. So if you look at the Hebrew, this particular verse that we just read, I'll read from the beginning. Moshe, do you see the place? Moshe?
On 49.
Okay, thank you. Moshe haya roe etzon Yitro chotin Midian. Translation, Moshe was shepherding the flock of Yitro, the father-in-law, his father-in-law, Kohen Midian, the priest of Midian. Then it says, "Vin hag et atzon," and he drove the flock achar hamidbar. Do you know that word midbar?
Mm-hmm.
It means desert. What does achar mean? Anyone know? Ever hear the word acharei? After. He drove the flock after the desert. He drove the flock beyond the desert. He drove, in other words, it's probably an idiomatic way of saying that he drove the flock far into the desert, ahar, after, beyond the desert, just beyond the border, far into the desert. And that wording only exacerbates the question, how far away was this, and where was he going, and did he often do this? Why did Moshe go so far away? And perhaps one of the ways of dealing with that is think about, well, where did he go? He went to this place called Horeb, the mountain of God. Sinai, the mountain of God. Now, it's easy to say, and it certainly makes sense, that why is it called the mountain of God? Because it will become the mountain of God. That's where the Torah will be given in another few months after this happens. That's where the Torah will be given. But it's possible, this isn't the only interpretation, it's possible that this is the mountain of God, not only because of what will happen in the future, but perhaps it's the mountain of God even in the present. Not just because of the burning bush that's about to happen in a few seconds, but perhaps this is a place that has a reputation, that has a history, that has a past as a mountain of God. Something has gone there in the future. And perhaps what we have here is that Moses has taken his sheep far into the desert in order to reach the mountain of God. If we learn it like that, and this again is not directly written in the text, but it's possible, if we read it like that, it means that Moses is already some type of spiritual character. He's a shepherd. And shepherds have lots of time on their hands. I just remember that this past Shabbat, it was just 4 days ago, I went with a walk, went with my wife on a walk, a Shabbat afternoon. And we walked for about an hour. And as we first left the town in which we live, Alon Shvut, and we went walking far away, we passed a shepherd with his flock, standing in a certain place with a stick in his hand, and 50 minutes later when we came back, I noticed him in the same place. He had the same stick in his hand. What I'm trying to say is shepherds have time on their hands, right? They're just shepherding, they're watching the flock. If everything goes well, they have to do nothing.
Waiting for the Lord to call
him. Waiting. Right? And the truth is, we have a tradition that shepherding goes along with spirituality. Because you have time on your hands, you sit out in the middle of nowhere, and you either you twiddle your thumbs, or you think, you contemplate, you look at nature. Right, Abraham was a shepherd. Yitzhak was a shepherd. Yaakov was a shepherd. Their sons were shepherds. King David was a shepherd. And it's not only that shepherds have time on their hands, they have time to think and contemplate and commune with God, they also shepherd their flock, and that's a metaphor, and it's also a preparation example for shepherding a flock, shepherding a human flock. God shepherds his flock, and the leader shepherds his flock as God's emissary. What I'm trying to say in this rather long-winded fashion is that it could be this verse is telling us that Moses was already a spiritual person. He was going far into the desert in order to commune with God, and he was going to the mountain of God. And perhaps he did this more than once. Perhaps he did it often. We don't know.
And the father-in-law was a Kohen, so he was probably observant.
Last word you said was, I didn't
observant,
hear.
Observant, maybe? Or
a...
Observant.
Well, his father was a Kohen for certain, but not of Judaism, right? A Kohen of the idolatrous religion of Midian. He was a priest of idolatry. But that doesn't mean that he wasn't a deeply spiritual person, right? And you're certainly right that Moses could have learned an awful lot from his father-in-law. An awful lot. An awful lot of important and meaningful things. I'll tell you something else, a midrash not brought in our booklet here. There's a midrash that says that the verse is not telling us so much about Moses' spirituality as it's telling us about Moses' morality. The midrash says, why did Moses shepherd his flocks achar hamidbar, beyond the desert, far into the desert? Because he didn't want to shepherd his flocks in places of civilization, because there, it's very easy for the flocks to tend into someone else's field and ruin, destroy produce that's growing, or just take grass that doesn't belong to them. So Moses went far away where no one owned the land because of his deep sense of ethics. That's a midrash. So whether you take it that he went where he went for spiritual reasons or he went where he went for ethical reasons, the verse could be setting up the character of Moshe, why he is a special, unique individual fitting to lead the Jewish people. Are you about to say something, Bruce? Like a smile on your face, like something is developing there.
Well, I was thinking of some of our discussions on Friday morning.
Ah, right. by the connection, right, about damages and that being an important part of ethics.
I just want to know, how much is there to eat in the desert for his flock?
I guess just scrub grass, you know, not too much.
I don't know how ethical it is to expose them to almost no food.
I see. Depends how much rain there was, right? Myra.
So if he kind of like had a trial run there, how come he couldn't find his way back out when he was leading his people?
We'll actually get to that. Very good point. I hope to get to that. Okay, let's go a little bit further. Two. An angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire out of a bush. He gazed, and there was a bush all aflame, yet the bush was not consumed. Moshe said, I must turn aside to look at this marvelous sight. Why doesn't the bush burn up? When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to look, God called to him out of the bush, Moshe, Moshe. He answered, here I am. So I have a question for you. What characteristic of Moshe is highlighted by the verses we just read?
He's inquisitive.
Curious. He's curious, right?
But he also says, here I am, without a question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He probably was asking, who is it that said my name, and what's going on here? Right. So the impression I get is that not every human being would have noticed that the bush is not consumed. Because you think of it, you know, it's one thing to notice that a bush is on fire. And that's pretty easy to notice. But it's another thing to notice that it's not consumed. Because if you look for 5 seconds, what do you notice? You notice that it's on fire. You have to look for 5 seconds, another 5 seconds, another 5 seconds, another 5 seconds. You have to look for a good 10 or 15 minutes to notice that this fire is a unique type of fire, that it's not consuming the bush. So Moshe had patience, and he had a certain curious, inquisitive nature. He was drawn to look deep, to contemplate this bush. Again, not everyone would have reacted in the same patient, inquisitive fashion that he did. And it's only after that God saw that he turned aside to look that God called out to him. You see what I'm saying? In other words, this in a certain sense was a test. And if Moses had not noticed that the bush is out of the ordinary, it could be that God would have not said to him, Moshe, Moshe. But only after God saw that Moses saw, right? And that's it's the same word here. In verse 2, when it says he gazed, the Hebrew word is v'yar, he saw. And in verse 4, it says that God, yar, God saw. Only when God saw that Moses saw, God reacted to Moses seeing. But if Moses hadn't seen, then God wouldn't have reacted.
Isn't there some thought that only righteous people see God's miracles?
There's certainly such a thing.
So here is one of God's miracles, a bush that burns that doesn't burn.
Right.
You know, I was almost thinking, was this the same area where they discovered natural gas in Israel?
I don't know. You can start exploring right now. By the way, since Bruce brought it up, have all of you heard, or some of you heard of Zion Oil and Gas, the exploration company? I'll just say a few words about them. I didn't plan to talk about this, but Bruce brought it up. We have this group of Christian evangelicals who have a deep, deep faith in God and the Jewish people and want to serve the world and the Jewish people. They want to help the Jewish people, help the state of Israel. They formed a for-profit publicly traded company called Zion Oil and Gas that is searching for gas on land in Israel. They've been drilling now for, I think, about 13 years. They haven't found anything yet. But they continue to sell stock, and Christian evangelicals around the U.S. and around the world continue to buy stock, not so much because they want to make money, but because they want to help the Jewish people. They want to find oil to make Israel energy sufficient. And when they do find oil, they have already put plans in place to donate most of the proceeds, after, of course, the stockholders get what they deserve, to different Jewish charities in Israel and in the U.S. and around the world. I've become connected to them because they're interested in learning Torah. They see themselves connected to the Torah of Israel. I spoke at their stockholders meeting a few months ago. They had evangelicals from around the U.S. coming to hear seismological reports and reports from the stock market and to talk, hear a rabbi talk. And in the past few months, I've been giving the staff of the group classes. I had a class before Purim, a class before Pesach, and a class before Shavuot. And it's quite an experience, I must say. Quite an experience. Anyway, that's the perhaps that's the source of the burning bush. So, where were we? We were saying that Moses was patient and perceptive. And I'll just pick up on what Bruce said. That right, this is a miracle that's not miraculous unless you take the time to see it as such. And that just might be a good paradigm for lots of miracles. They're not miracles until you take the time to see them as such. Not only because Moses had the personality and the proclivity to see it as such, did God reach out to him. Okay. Going on, next verse. Verse 5. And he said, "Do not come closer. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you stand is holy ground." So, to me, this verse is very significant. I make a big deal of this verse. Just think of the following. I'm walking in the street, and I see an old friend I haven't seen for 70, 80 years. And I call out to him, "Moshe, Moshe." And Moshe, my old friend, says, "Here I am." He looks at me, and I say, "Don't come closer." Is that a way to greet an old friend? Now just think in these verses, God could have said, "Moses, give me a great big hug." Or, "No, come closer, I want to look at you in the eyes. I want to be together with you."
Oh, sorry.
But instead, God says, "Do not come closer. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place in which you stand is holy ground." To me, this is very significant for Jewish theology. That on the one hand, we have an appearance of God here. God is close, God is near. To Moshe, at least. But at the same time that God is here, God is close, God is near, God says, "Keep your distance. Don't come any closer. Take off your shoes and feel a sense of yirah, a sense of awe, because this is holy ground." And what I'm trying to say is, we have here a unique combination of closeness and of distance. To use theological language, we have a combination of imminence and transcendence. It's God here, I would almost say, is afraid of allowing Moses to feel too close, to feel too connected. And even though God here wants to appear, and he wants Moses to feel that this is he, this is God's presence, the first message is keep your distance. And some of you heard the classes that I gave on Judaism and Christianity, why the Jews rejected Jesus, right? A few months ago, we talked about the same theme, that Judaism is very keen to keep us aware of God's distance, God's otherness. So here you have it right here. I don't know if I mentioned these verses. I probably did when we studied Judaism and Christianity. We probably actually mentioned this verse. That even when there's that closeness, there's a real sense of distance and difference. Stay away. Do not come closer. Okay. So then God goes on to say, and he said, "I am," he said, "the God of your father, the God of Avram, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, was afraid to look at God. And that moment in which Moses hides his face, that's exactly the proper reaction. You can't look, you can't feel too close. Yeah, Myra.
Do you think it's that we could never make an idol out of?
Never make an idol out of?
God.
Obviously, exactly. That's exactly it. Right? You don't look, you don't feel too close, you don't feel that you have God in your back pocket.
You can't have much respect and awe for somebody that you are so familiar with that you literally speak to them as an equal.
Right, I mean, exactly. You know, 100%. 100%.
So there has to be this balance between respect and awe and faith that somehow this has to be in the mix.
Exactly. Right. And that's what we talked about in the classes on Judaism and Christianity, that from the Jewish point of view, Christianity makes God too here, too close, too imminent, too knowable, too experienceable, too much like you and I. Whereas God says in these verses, I'm here, but stay away, keep your distance. Take off your shoes, and Moses takes the cue, he understands you can't look. And that's a great sense of against distance, and I probably, and I'm repeating myself, but since I don't remember, you probably don't remember either. I very often mention how difficult it is for me to look other people in the eye, and I'm looking at the people in the room right now, and I'm having this difficulty, because it's too intimate. It's too invasive. I can only look someone in the eye when I really, 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 really know them very well. And here Moses has that same sense with God. He can't look at God in the eye. It's just forbidden. It's too invasive. God has to be distant. Yeah. Okay. So we're going on now. And there's one other question I want to ask in verse 6. When God says, I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, well, what does Moses say to himself? Does he remember who Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are? Does it ring a bell with him? Does he have any sense of familiarity? I mean, it's been a long time since he's had any contact with Jewish culture, and even when he did have that contact, they were slaves, and he was in the palace, and the last time he really heard... had a family connection was when he was 2 years old. So what does all this mean to him? Does it mean anything at all? It's an open question.
Well, I think it would mean something if somebody says, listen, I just want to tell you, I've been around. I mean, you know, all of your forebears, they knew about me.
Yeah.
And they heard about me. And they believed in me. They had faith.
But how much of a connection does Moses have to those forebears?
He gave up his whole palace life for them.
Purposely or accidentally? It's hard to know.
Wait a minute. No, I mean, if you think that all of this was kind of foreordained, that he would free the people. But I mean, I'm not so sure whether the Hebrews in the Egyptian slavery outfit didn't talk about old times and didn't have family stories and didn't talk about it. And whether he didn't know about it, we don't really know that.
Right, we don't know. We don't know.
We know in current history, in slavery in the United States, there was great oral histories passed down all the time from father to son,
mm-hmm.
And eventually when slaves became literate, many of those were put down on paper,
mm-hmm.
and recorded.
But you raised the question, how would he know of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? They wouldn't know from his father. Father-in-law would he? His father-in-law would tell him about other gods.
Yeah. His father-in-law would tell him about other gods. His adoptive father, Paro, would tell him about Egyptian gods. And his real father, he hasn't seen his real father since he was 2 or 3 years old. Right.
Well, how long did he live as a slave?
Did he live as a slave?
I mean,
he never lived as a slave.
Didn't he beat a slave? I mean, didn't he beat a taskmaster?
Right, so when
he was
15 or 20 years old, those incidents happened, and he never became a slave. He became a fugitive. So certainly his Jewish education was lacking. Right. Okay. Let's see. That's the verse. One other thing that I want to mention here is that look how God describes himself. The God of your father, the God of Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. God doesn't describe what he is, but describes his relationships with people in the past. That God describes his track record and doesn't give any type of theological definition. I'm the God who's invisible, omnipotent, and omniscient. Doesn't say that. God doesn't talk in theological language. God talks in relational language. We'll come back to that later. Okay. And the Lord continued, I've marked well the plight of my people in Egypt, and I've heeded their outcry because of their taskmasters. Yes, I am mindful of their sufferings. I've come down to rescue them, the Egyptians, bring them out of the land to a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the region of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. Now the cry of the Israelites has reached me. More have they seen how the Egyptians oppress them. Come.
Rob?
Yes.
I have a question about the highlighting of in 7 of my people.
Mm-hmm.
Is that highlighted in the Hebrew? Because the plight of my people is different than the plight of my people.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Well, they're now saying, I mean, how do we recognize here? Are they just any people or my people? That's what I'm getting at.
Well, God calls them my people.
Right, but his people would also be in other places.
There are other
peoples around, and God is now saying, identifying with the people in Egypt as being the only ones who are my people.
Right. I understand.
So,
no.
Right.
So since God chose Abraham back 400 years before this, the Jewish people, perhaps I should not call them the Jewish people, but call them the Abraham and his descendants, become my people. At least in a relative sense, other nations are less of his people.
Okay. Is the translation of verse Zion correct?
My people?
Yeah, I mean, look at it in the script, please.
Right, the Hebrew is Ami.
Ami.
Which is Am Shali, my people. That's literally the case. We can look at it in the Hebrew. I'm reading in the Hebrew verse Zion, the 7th verse, and it says, V'yomer Hashem, Ra'ol ra'iti et oni ami, which means, said God, see, I see the oppression of ami. Ami is my people. Am Shali. I can put that on the board.
I hope I can put it on the board. Well, that marker's not going to work. Ami is a contraction of Am Shali. Am Shali, the people of me, becomes Ami. The Yud is added to the end of the word and becomes my people. So that is literally correct. That's what it means.
But if you think that he's that they have been, he has marked well the plight of my people. Well, the plight was only experienced by the slaves, right?
Yeah.
So then you would assume that these were all the descendants of Abraham. And to answer Howard's question, it is those people.
Yes.
That have had the plight.
Right. Okay. All the descendants of Ephraim, Yitzchak, and Yaakov.
Yes, I see that now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So going back to verse 10, we read 10. Come therefore, I will send you to Paro, and you shall free my people. There it is again, my people, the Israelites from Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Paro and free the Israelites from Egypt? So Moses basically says, wait a second.
Why me?
Why me? And if you just think of how crazy this whole thing is, how out of left field. It's like I have a dream. And in the dream, God tells me to buy a one-way plane ticket to Nicaragua and to free these slaves from the dictator who's leading that country. And I say, where is that place? I mean, I don't even speak Spanish. I mean, why me? It's been 70 years or 65 years since Moses has been to Egypt. He knows nothing what's going on there. Oh, who am I? I'm a shepherd. Leave me alone. It's a bad dream. And just imagine how disconcerting this is. How much tension and pain it must cause Moses. He has a good life. He has a wife. He has children. He has a fine father-in-law. He's a shepherd. He might be a spiritual man. He might be searching for God. But to suddenly become a politician, a leader, are you crazy? Not only do I not want to stand in front of Paro, but how can I represent those Israelites? I haven't seen them for 65 years. Moses might not even speak Hebrew, by the way. How would he speak Hebrew? Who would have taught him the language?
You weren't there to teach him.
And neither was his father or mother. So he's really completely disconnected from this whole thing, and the proposal, I'm calling it a proposal, the demand of God is outlandish. It's totally outlandish. So Moses obviously has to find a basis to refuse. Who am I that I should go to Paro and free the Israelites from Egypt? Why me? Choose someone else. Goodness gracious. But God, of course, insists. And he said, I will be with you. That shall be your sign that it was I who sent you. When you free the people from Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. That verse is very unclear. I mean, Moses is really uptight here. He says, I just can't do it. It's not for me. I'm not fitting. I'm not connected. Look for someone else. And God's answer is, I will be with you. Okay, that sounds good. That's a little bit comforting. I don't have to go alone. God's going to be with me. But then the next thing, that shall be your sign that it was I who sent you. What's the sign? It's really not clear.
Well, maybe it doesn't mean sign. It is the power that you get by me sending you. It is the the force by sending you, but not the belief that I'm sending you.
Uh-huh.
I sent you off with all these
qualities, one possibility.
Of courage and whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, otherwise it makes no sense.
Yeah. Oh, one additional way of looking at it is that the second half of verse 12, that you'll worship God on this mountain, is what's referenced by the phrase, your sign, in the first half of the verse. In other words, it goes like this, and he said, I'll be with you, and this shall be the sign that it was I who sent you, that after you freed the people from Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain.
So the sign comes after?
The sign comes after. In other words, it's God is comforting Moses and saying, I'll be with you for the long haul, and there'll be a closing of the circle. After you take them out of Egypt, you'll come back to this very mountain, and you'll worship God here. That's going to be the Ten Commandments. That's going to be the Theophany at Sinai. Right? So God is saying, I'm going to be with you for the long haul, and you'll eventually be able to have confirmed in the eyes of all the people, the fact that it was all from God, because they'll come and they'll experience God, all the people, on this mountain at the end of the process. That's another possibility.
Sounds like Dr. Spock.
You mean Star Trek?
It's Star Trek.
I see.
Let the Force be with you.
Yeah, it's always with you. Okay. Verse 13. Moses said to God, when I come to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And the way I would read this is that Moses is basically saying, God, give me your business card. I mean, when I go to the people and I say that this being appointed me to lead you out of Egypt, they want to know who this being is. They want a way to identify you. They want a way to be certain that this is really serious. So God, tell me your name. Tell me who you are. Tell me something about you so I can say something about you to them and convince them that really was a God that spoke to me and sent me on this mission. That all makes perfect sense. And of course, certainly in biblical thought, the name represents something of the essence of the person, of the being. The name describes what it is, or what he is, or what she is. Whether it's an animal, whether it's a person, whether it's an object, the name gives you a certain sense of familiarity. And therefore, verse 14, the next verse, is that much more amazing. And God said to Moses, Eheyeh asher eheyeh, I will be what I will be. He continued, thus shall you say to the Israelites, Eheyeh, I will be, sent me to you. That's like a case in which I meet someone on the street, and we have something in common, we start talking, and he or she asks me, what's your name? And my name is, I say to them, my name is whatever it is. My name is whatever it is. That's what my name is. That's what God says to Moses. Tell the people, my name is whatever it is. Which is another way of saying, I'm not telling you my name.
Also means it doesn't make any difference what my name is.
Doesn't make any difference. You can't know what my name is. I'm not willing to tell you. I'm not going to reveal it.
And I'm God.
Say it again.
And I'm God.
That's all.
There.
Now, I want to understand this verse in which God is not willing to reveal his name. In light of the verse we saw earlier, this was verse 5, in which God said, do not come closer. Now, here's a second point at which God is making very clear that there's a certain line that cannot be crossed. Don't come closer and don't dare ask me my name, because I'm not telling you. And even though Moses had claimed, I have to know your name in order to take upon myself this mission. If you don't tell me the name, I won't be able to convince the people that really some type of being sent me. And they'll just laugh in my face and say, if you don't know his name, then how could you represent him? And God says, despite the fact that you, Moses, have to know, you say, my name in order to go on this mission, I'm still, even though I demand you go on the mission, I'm not telling you my name.
Could it be that God wanted to see if Moshe had enough faith in him to carry out what God's plan was for him?
Could be.
Because without having that faith, you know, today, in today's world, if we have faith in somebody, we listen to them.
Even if you don't know their name.
Even if you don't know their name.
It's like a salesman comes and says, buy these stocks for me. And yes, well, what do they invest in? Have faith in me. I'm kind of making fun.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a con artist. That way, because that's how people get swindled out of their money. They're ripped off. But here, God is also isn't God testing Moshe? To see if he is strong enough.
Yeah, I understand.
To accept God and believe that God is, or that believe whoever the shadowy thing is for real.
I personally, I'm telling you my personal feeling, I have difficulty believing that God is giving a test of faith to Moshe, because why should Moses be expected to live up to such a test? Again, he's a Midianite shepherd. That's what he is. Why should he have any faith in God to begin with? For as far as we know, this is the first contact he'd had with the Jewish God idea for 65 years.
Not to speak of the fact that how would the people back in Egypt relate to him when he comes marching in and says all of that? I mean, are they really accepting? How would you go about it that they would accept his message? I want to go see Pharaoh. I want to be your spokesperson. I'm going to be the leader. I mean, it boggles the mind to think that.
Yeah.
You know, Pharaoh sits up in that chair crusted with gold, he's there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's there. He's a corporeal being, but God is incorporeal.
He's just a burning bush.
That's it.
At this point.
He's a burning bush who doesn't want him to a divulge that his mother told him, you're going to be God.
Myra.
I don't really see it as a problem. If I was a slave in Egypt and somebody came along and said, hey, I want to free you, I'm going to go to Pharaoh and talk to you, I would go, you have my permission. Mm-hmm. Then go for it. I don't care who you are. If you think you can get us the hell out of here.
I understand. Okay. Okay.
Now it's a matter of whether Pharaoh is going to listen to him, but I mean, if he's a self-appointed, you know, spokesman for the slaves, then who else is Pharaoh going to listen to? But I certainly would give him my vote.
Give him a chance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What could be worse? I'm a slave. I'm still going to be a slave.
Although, let's remember that one of the first things that happens later on in the story, when Moses goes as a representative of the people to Paro, that Paro ends up increasing their workload.
Well, okay, that's the option, but still, I mean, if there's a 50% chance that this guy's legit,
It's worth trying.
Yeah.
It's worth trying. Okay, so the verses go on. I'm reading 14 and 15. And God said to Moshe, Heyeh Asher Heyeh, I am what I am. He continues, thus shall thou say to the Israelites, Eheyeh sent me to you. Before we read verse 15, I just want to point out that the word that the Torah uses for the unique God of Israel, Yud Ke Vav Ke, is a form of the word Eheyeh, to be, I will be. Now there's the word that we pronounce as Adonai, the name of God, means being. I am. In other words, all we can say about God is that He is. But we don't say anything about what He is. We don't give Him a name. Because a name, again, would indicate something of His personality, something of His essence, something what He really is. But the whole idea is, we can't know anything of what He is. He says, keep a distance. Stay away. Take off your shoes. You can't know my name. It's all part of the same theology, that together with the immanence, together with the closeness of God, together with the nearness, there's a real sense that you have to know that you can't know. You have to know that God is other, that God is distant. You can't even give Him a name that describes anything except to the fact that He is. And God said further to Moses, thus shall you speak to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This shall be my name forever. This is my appellation for eternity. In other words, what is my name? My name is simply my track record. That I've had a relationship with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. I don't have a real name that describes who I am. I don't have a name that describes my essence. I don't have a name that describes my personality. But I have a track record that says, you can rely on me because of what I've done in the past. And by the way, this is connected to what we always say in Judaism, you don't know God for what He is, you know God for what He does. And to go further with that, it's almost like there's no Jewish theology. If theology is the science of God, well, what can you say about God? The answer is nothing. But what God is, does the Torah say that God is omnipotent? No. Does it say that God is omnipresent? No. Does it say God is green? No. Does it say God is all over? No. Does it say God is anything? No. All you know is what God does, what God did and what He does, but not what He is. Okay. So God says, and now we're getting into some really, really interesting stuff. Here I'm going to read verses 16, 17, and 18. Go and assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Avram, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob has appeared to me and has said, I have taken note of you in what is being done to you in Egypt. And I have declared I will take you out of the misery of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, land flowing with milk and honey. They will listen to you. Then you shall go with the elders of Israel to the king of Egypt, and you shall say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, manifested himself to us. Now therefore let us go a distance of 3 days into the wilderness to sacrifice to the Lord our God. Does anyone see the amazing difficulty in these verses? The tension? Something that it just boggles the mind, what I just read. There's something terrible. There's something morally repugnant in these verses.
Well, he sets up how they're going to play a ruse on
it. Ah, right.
he tells them how to fool them.
Right.
You need to go 3 days in the wilderness and pray.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, you know, this is how we newly found a God. We need to worship him.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, we need to leave for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. In other words,
thing is a fib.
God tells Moses to lie. Do you see what we're saying here? God says explicitly in verses 16 and 17, tell the Israelites that this God, me, is going to take you from slavery to freedom. From the land of Egypt to the land of Canaan, the land flowing with milk and honey. You're going from slavery to freedom. And tell Paro that you're going for a 3-day vacation into the wilderness. In other words, tell Paro you want a 3-day holiday to worship your God, which clearly and unequivocally implies that you're coming back to slavery after 3 days. And of course, we know what the intention is. The intention is to fool Paro, like Miriam said, to pull the wool over his eyes, and when you're on your 3-day holiday, to not come back. So you say, Gavoth, what's going on here? God is a liar. Has v'shalom that I should say that. And God is telling Moses to lie. Now, what's going on here? Why is this going on? It's ridiculous. First of all, why would God lie? And why would God tell Moses to lie? And secondly, why would God need to do such a thing? I mean, God doesn't have the power to take them out of Egypt from slavery to freedom without a lie? Can't God just zap the Egyptians and take them out? Take the Israelites out? What's going on here? This is really, really difficult. This is an amazing theological and moral issue. I hope you're riled up enough about this.
Well, I can see where this battle plan, so to speak, has to do also with the acclimatization, if that is a word, of the Israelites to what's going to come. First we're going to do this, and then we're going to do that. And it's going to be followed up by this. I mean, there have to be steps in it. And if it takes a lie, so be it. And let's see first whether they're going to go, if they get to go.
Mm.
And what are the chances that they may not be able to go? And how do they relate to that? I can see kind of like preparing all of these different miracles and different things that are going to happen.
Okay, I hear.
That doesn't justify him from lying.
But I'm going to respond to you, Miriam, because note that God doesn't tell Moses to tell the Israelites about the 3-day holiday, just to tell Paro.
Yeah, but I mean, they're involved in it. He has to tell, assuming Pharaoh says, yeah, go, he has to tell the Israelites, listen, pack up, let's go.
You know, but Moses is going to tell the Israelites, we're going for good. It's only Paro that he's...
I understand that.
So therefore, it's hard for me to see it as a preparation, as a slow getting used to it for the Israelites, because they don't even know about the 3-day thing. Only Paro has heard about that. They're told we're going from slavery to freedom.
In 3 days.
No. What do you mean in 3 days? No, they're told we're just going and never coming back.
Get your stuff up,
but
leave.
But isn't this a grand scheme to show the people that the God of Moses is smarter than Pharaoh? He tricked Pharaoh. You know, I can just see that, you know, Cecil B. DeMille doing this. God saying, only tell Pharaoh
right.
that you're going to
right.
be gone for a 3-day long weekend. And Pharaoh will say, oh, happy, everybody will come back and work twice as hard on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, that's what seems to be going on.
And so then when Moses, after the 3 days, when they are twice as far away as they say they were going to go, he says, you see, I told the old bird we were just going to be back here. And now we're still mm-hmm. marching south or whatever direction they were
going. Yeah. That's certainly a very good part of it. Myra?
Maybe it was an attempt to try to not have to use force. You know, let's see if we can get out this way, and then we won't have to kill,
uh-huh.
you know, the firstborns. you know, we won't have to have the plagues and all that kind of stuff. Or, you know, maybe we can just dupe him into leaving. We won't have to have any bloodshed.
Okay, I hear. But then we should read the rest of the verses. After we just read verse 19. Yet I know that the king of Egypt will let you go only because of a greater might. Because even if you tell him just 3 days, he's still not going to let you go. So I'll stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with various wonders which I will work upon them. After that, he shall let you go. So it looks like even given the 3 day ruse, it's still envisioned, a plan is envisioned that's going to involve the force of the 10 plagues. What I want to do now is I want to rub in the moral quandary we have in reading these verses. Because I want to show that Moses did exactly what God said. And he lied to Paro again and again and again and again and again and again and again. And we don't have time to look at the 15 different verses we can quote, but we can look at 5 different sets of verses throughout the story of the 10 plagues. So let's start with chapter 5, verses 1 to 3 in Exodus. We have to open up the Tanakh to Exodus, chapter 5, verses 1 to 3. So this is going to be the first time that Moses actually goes to Paro. Chapter 5, verses 1 to 3. You ready? Afterward, Moshe and Aaron went and said to Paro, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may celebrate a festival for me in the wilderness." But Paro said, "Who is the Lord, that I shall heed him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, nor will I let Israel go." They answered, "The God of the Hebrews has manifested himself to us. Let us go, we pray, a distance of 3 days into the wilderness to sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he strike us with pestilence or sword." Right? Because so they're saying, God demanded of us a 3 day worship sermon. If we don't do it, you're going to lose your slaves. He's going to kill us. So please let us go for worship 3 days into the desert. Moses does not ask for freedom. Even though Moses knows the ultimate goal is to get out and not come back. So Moses plays according to the rule book that God set up, which is to lie to Paro. Let's see another set of verses. Chapter 7, verse 16. Chapter 7, verse 16. And here already the plagues are starting. The first plague, of course, is the plague of the blood. So we're in chapter 7, verse 16.
125.
And it says the following. And say to him, as God tells Moses to say to Paro at the beginning of the first plague, the plague of blood, "The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you to say, let my people go, that they may worship me in the wilderness." It's not just let my people go. It's that they may worship me in the wilderness, which implies worship and come back. So, if we're going back to the 1950s and 60s in the south of the U.S., and the blacks are singing, "Let my people go," that's a misquote, right? When we're singing, I learned this when I was in grade school, we learned some of these spirituals, right? "Let my people go," you know, "go down Paro," and all that stuff. It's not a full quote. It wasn't "let my people go," it's "let my people go that they may worship me in the wilderness." Let's see another set of verses. Chapter 8, verse 4. Here we already have the second plague, the frogs. And the frogs come upon Paro, and what does Paro do? Verse 4, "Then Paro summoned Moses and Aaron and said, plead with the Lord to remove the frogs from me and my people, and I will let the people go to sacrifice to the Lord." Not to freedom. "I'll let them go to sacrifice to the Lord. That's all that you asked of me. That's all I'm going to give you," says Paro to Moses. And now let's look at chapter 8, verse 21 to 24. Here we're talking about the swarms of insects. The plague that comes after you have the blood, and after you have the frogs, and after you have the lice, and then you have the fourth one, which is the insects. And in chapter 8, verse 21, "Then Paro summoned Moses and Aaron and said, go and sacrifice to your God within the land. I'll let you go. to sacrifice, but don't go beyond the boundaries of Egypt, stay within the land. But Moses replied, it would not be right to do this, for what we sacrifice to the Lord our God is untouchable to the Egyptians. We're going to sacrifice sheep, which are the gods of the Egyptians. If we sacrifice that which is untouchable to the Egyptians before their very eyes, will they not stone us? So we must go a distance of 3 days into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God as he may command us. Paro said, I will let you go to sacrifice the Lord your God in the wilderness, but do not go very far. Okay, you can leave the land, go into the wilderness, but don't go too far. So Moses here is adding to the lie. And he's saying, the reason we have to go into the wilderness to sacrifice for 3 days is because if we do it in the land, the Egyptians will stone us. We're sacrificing the God that they worship. But it's all based on this lie that it's 3 days. And Paro here agrees to let them go for 3 days into the wilderness. Obviously, the assumption is that they are coming back. And lastly, there's lots more verses we could look at, but we're going to look just one more set of verses, chapter 10, verse 7 to 11. This is after the plague of the hail. Things got really bad in Egypt. 10, verse 7. Paro's courtiers said to him, how long shall this one be a snare to us? Let the men go worship the Lord their God. Are you not yet aware that Egypt is lost, destroyed? So Moses and Aaron were brought back to Paro, and he said to them, go worship the Lord your God. Not freedom, go worship. But then Paro adds, who are the ones to go? Who do you mean is going to worship? Moses replied, we all go. We will all go, young and old. We must go with our sons and daughters, our flocks and our herds, for we must observe the Lord's festival. But he said to them, Paro says back, the Lord be with you, the same as I mean to let your children go with you. Clearly you are bent on mischief. Whereas Paro says, you're lying. If you only want to go to worship God for 3 days, why do you need to take your children with you? Why do you need to take your flocks and your goats with you? So Paro goes and says, no, you men folk go and worship the Lord, since that is what you want. I'm only going to let the men go. Because it's only about worship, and only men are part of religion. You don't need the women and the children and the flocks. So again, it's all based on this matter of 3 days for worship. And Paro understands that perhaps Moses is trying to dupe him, but he's not going to be duped, he says. I'm just going to let the men go. So, since we've shown that from beginning to end, it's always about this 3 day holiday, and it's not about slavery to freedom, we have to ask ourselves a very, 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 very big question. Why? Why does God insist on lying? And why does God insist on Moses lying? And why do you have to dupe Paro? Why can't you just tell Paro, we're going out of here, we're never coming back, and God will make the 10 plagues to let Paro give in, and what's it all about? So,
You've given a bad view. I mean, there are ways to, other than calling it a lie, there's a ruse for a ruse, something for a better good. And
yes.
I don't concur with your view of it. I mean, this was the only way it could happen. It was a plan that God devised.
Well, why was it the only way?
Pull out. And so, why put that term of lying in it, which is tells us all that is bad? This is good. And the only way that he could get it out. Each woman shall borrow from her neighbor. Borrow means you're going to be, you say, I'm going to borrow, I'm going to bring it back to you. The whole thing is a plan.
I agree it's a plan.
But it's not a lie.
Well, what do other people in the room say? Is it a lie? Is it not a lie?
It's on the roofs.
If you have to lie to save people, is that a lie?
Okay. So Howard says that it's justified.
It's definition.
You're taking it too seriously what we say.
Because in our history we lied.
We have to do that sometimes in order to get things done, right? Get to the right result. It's a trick.
It's a trick.
Call it a trick instead of a lie.
Trick is fine.
It's a trick. I'm gonna stand my ground here.
If you're gonna teach your children not to lie, why would you bring in lying as being okay?
I agree with you. That's exactly the question here. This is really right. Are you allowed to lie to for a larger good?
Yes.
Right? Could you have lied to the Nazis to save
yes.
50 people? And you probably could, right?
Yes.
Right. Of course.
We are very proud of them today that they did.
So lying certainly is at certain times not only permitted, but it's actually a virtue. Like say, right? But it's still a lie. Right? It's still a lie. It's a lie. It's a ruse. It's a trick. It's a lie. But it might be permitted. And since God commands you there, I'm certainly going to assume that it's good and it's right. But it's still a lie. But what we have to ask is, okay, lying may be permitted, and it is permitted for a higher good. But what's the higher good here? What's the higher good? Do you think that God couldn't have taken the Israelites from slavery to freedom without a lie? Did God need this lie? Why couldn't God just have said to Moses, tell the truth? You're going from slavery to freedom, and if Pharaoh doesn't agree, we'll give him one plague after another until we break his will. Why was this lie necessary? And the answer I'm now going to present, I think, is in the simple meaning of the verses, and it's quite astounding. The answer may be the following, according to some commentators. The purpose of the lie was to create the scenario of the splitting of the Red Sea, in which the pursuing Egyptian army would all be drowned. Now, I have to explain what I mean by that. But just let's think about it a little bit. Had Paro understood the truth, been told the truth, that the Israelites are going from slavery to freedom, and after the last plague he would have let them go because his country was totally destroyed, then obviously he wouldn't have chased after them after let them go. Why did he chase after them? Because he realized he'd been duped.
That's right.
And the claim I'm making now is that all of this was part of the divine plan. God wanted to dupe Paro, and God wanted Paro to realize he'd been duped, and wanted Paro to be so indignant about being duped that he would actually take his whole army and pursue the Israelites and catch them at the sea. And then, as the sea split, Paro's army would go after the Israelites because they're so indignant out of being lied to, and then the sea will close over them and kill them all. And I still have to prove that all this is true, and we still have to show, so why did God want the whole Egyptian army to pursue the Israelites and be killed to the sea? Why? Couldn't have God just killed them another fashion? I have to answer that question also. So let's read the verses now. We're going to go to the verses describing the splitting of the sea. And by the way, these are verses we read in synagogue just 4 days ago. Because when was the splitting of the sea? On the seventh day of Passover. And we say that the seventh of Passover, we just celebrated this Friday and Saturday, is the celebration of the splitting of the seas. And we read over the holiday chapter 14, not 15, 14. Chapter 14. It looks like we're not even going to get to any of the commentaries in our workbook, but this is really important stuff. And it's really relevant to the holiday we just celebrated. So now we're in chapter 14 of Exodus. The slaves have left Egypt for a three-day holiday. And it says in chapter 14, the Lord said to Moshe, tell the Israelites to turn back and encamp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea. Before Baal-Zephon, you shall encamp facing it by the sea. Paro will say of the Israelites, they are astray in the land. The wilderness has closed in on them. Then I will stiffen Paro's heart, and he will pursue them, that I may gain glory through Paro and all his hosts, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. So what's going on here? They've gone out for a three-day holiday. Paro, of course, has sent with them spies to make sure that they only go for three to then start coming back. And now these spies are going to see that instead of worshiping God in the wilderness, they seem to be searching for a way out. And now they got lost. They're at the sea. They're looking how to go. And the sea is closing the way for them. And they're stuck. And Paro's going to hear about this. And then Paro's heart will be stiffened. He'll say, ah, they're trying to trick me. I'm going to go and teach them a lesson. And they did so. Verse 5. When the king of Egypt was told by his spies that the people had fled, in other words, that they're not worshipping for 3 days. They're trying to get out. They're trying to find a way to leave the borders of Egypt completely. Paro and his courtiers had a change of heart about the people and said, what is this we have done releasing Israel from our servants? They realizing that they've been duped. And they're indignant. They're angry. They're extremely, extremely upset. He ordered his chariots and took his men with him. He took 600 of his picked chariots and the rest of the chariots of Egypt with officers and all of them. The Lord stiffened the heart of Paro, king of Israel, and he gave chase to the Israelites. What Paro is doing is totally irrational. He's suffered the 10 plagues. He knows that God has ground him down into mincemeat, has reduced the country to stubble, but Paro is so indignant because of the ruse that he's now discovered, he's defying all logic and sending his whole army against the Israelites. He should know it's not a good thing to do. But anger has gotten the best of him. And we know that the greatest anger is when you realize that you've been tricked. And you fell for it. You're angry at God, you're angry at Moses, you're angry at yourself. And this was all set up by God. It's all a setup. He's falling into the trap a second time. He thinks he's discovered the ruse, but he's actually only falling into it deeper. So he chases, and I'll read more. As the Israelites were departing defiantly, boldly, the Egyptians gave chase to them, and all the chariots, horse of Paro, his horsemen, and his warriors, overtook them and camped by the sea near Pi-Hahiroth before Baal-Zephon. As Paro drew near, the Israelites caught sight of the Egyptians advancing upon them. Greatly frightened, the Israelites cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, was it for want of graves in Egypt that you brought us out to die in the wilderness? What have we done? What have you done to us, taking us out of Egypt? Is this not the very thing we told you in Egypt, saying, let us be, we will serve the Egyptians, for it is better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. But Moses said to the people, have no fear, stand by and witness the deliverance which the Lord will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you will not see again. The Lord will battle for you, you hold your peace. So now, the claim we're making, and I think it's brought out by these verses, is the whole matter of the 3-day ruse from beginning to end was a plan. It was a plan for a purpose. And the purpose was exactly what we're seeing right now, to arouse the indignation of Paro that he's been duped, so he'll come and chase after the Egyptians, and all his army will be drowned in the sea. But wait a second. Why does God need to drown the whole army in the sea? What's the point? Is the point just to show God's greatness? Well, God has showed his greatness through the 10 plagues. There's a further point here, perhaps. The purpose of the whole thing might be, two words, psychological catharsis. Psychological catharsis. What we see is at this point that even though the Israelites have been taken by God out of Egypt, they're no longer slaves to Paro. They're no longer slaves physically, but psychologically they're still slaves. Because what do they say when they see these 600 chariots approaching? They say, whoa, we'd rather be slaves. What are they afraid of? They're 600,000 men against 600 chariots, and they should know the power of God has made these 10 plagues. The Israelites, their fear is irrational. Why are they afraid? Because through generations of slavery, they've been conditioned to look at themselves as slaves and to look at the Egyptians as taskmasters. They see themselves as second-class, inferior people. They have no sense of confidence, no sense of independence, no sense of self-worth, and they'd rather be slaves. That's what they say. So the point might be the following. God wants this great event to happen in which these slaves, the former slaves, look at the might of Egypt approaching and express this great fear. And then in one fell swoop, the object of their fear that they see right in front of them will be drowned in the sea. The purpose may be the psychological catharsis that they witness face to face the demise of the object of their fear. the object of their sense of inferiority, the object of their sense of slavitude, if there's such a word. And then, when the Egyptian army before their eyes is drowned in the sea, psychological catharsis, they will begin a process of losing that slave mentality, because they realize, they see face to face that God has done away with the objects of their servitude, with their enslavers.
But it would also go beyond that. It would give them religion.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that was something that would be needed by the Jewish people, the chosen people.
A sense of faith. A sense of faith, right? So it could be, therefore, to sum up everything, that this lie, this ruse, that was engineered from beginning to end, yes, it was a lie. Yes, it was a ruse. It was something that we'd usually consider to be immoral. But here it's a end that justifies the means. It's a means used here by God in order to create a situation in which the Israelites will be taken from slavery to freedom, not only physically, but emotionally, but psychologically. And God apparently realized that the move from slavery to freedom was as important on an emotional level as it is on a physical level. That just physical freedom from slavery would not be enough. There also had to be this whole big Cecil de DeMille
setup
in order to arrange the psychological catharsis. Now, by the way, that also wasn't enough, because we know throughout the coming months, they still have that psychological inferiority. They still always want to go back to Egypt. But there had to be a beginning of that process. And by the way, I wasn't involved in things that Bruce and Miriam were involved in the 50s and 60s in the U.S. But I assume that the same type of psychological sense of inferiority existed with American blacks for 100 years, perhaps longer. And there has to be a process, not only of physical freedom, but also of a psychological, spiritual release from the situation. Okay. We're slaves to the clock. Were you about to say something, Howard?
Well, we could talk about freedom for people. That's a constant process, whether they be blacks or Hispanic. I mean, trying to get that sense of freedom. Same type of thing. People have to go through quite a catharsis.
Yeah. Okay, let's read the rest of the verses.
This gives rise to that statement that we hear quite a bit, the Lord works in mysterious ways.
So, back in the verses, we are in verse 21. Let's do verse 21.
In chapter 14?
In chapter 3. I mean, back to the verses in the workbook.
I'm still in Tamar.
So, back to chapter 3, verse 21. And what we're about to see is something that someone just said 10 minutes ago. I can't remember who it was. Someone in our room here. 3:21. And I will dispose the Egyptians favorably towards this people, says God, so that when you go, you will not go empty-handed. Each woman shall borrow from her neighbor and the larger in her house objects of silver and gold and clothing. You shall put these on your sons and your daughters, thus stripping the Egyptians. The point I want to make here is the reason the Egyptians were willing to give all their vessels of gold and silver and their earrings and their finery to the Israelites is because the Israelites said, we need them for a three-day holiday. We're going to get dressed up. We need makeup and high heels and nice dresses and stuff to go worship God. We'll come back and give it back to you. And that also was part of the lie.
Oh, you think maybe they also, maybe they stole it. I'm not so sure whether this word borrow really means what it says.
No, of course you're right. In other words, they said we want to borrow it, but they knew that they were not going to return it. So all of this stuff was stolen.
Sure. I mean...
But then wait a second. How could God teach us to steal? The answer is probably pretty obvious. If you've been slaves for 210 years, your...
You need to get paid.
You need to get paid.
That's it.
Right? And if the only way to get your payment from your immoral taskmasters is to lie to them and say, I want to borrow a few things and I'll return them, and you don't return them, that is means justify the ends again.
They didn't lie to them at that point in time. They didn't know that they were going to be free.
No, they did know.
They did.
The Israelites knew.
I knew Moses knew, but the people didn't.
No, the verses we read said, tell the Israelites, you're going from slavery to freedom, land flowing with milk and honey. Just tell Paro it's 3 days. So apparently the Israelites knew. They were all involved in the ruse. So just say to everyone, you know, by the way, the verses we've read today are a central component in the larger moral discussion of do the ends ever justify the means? And from a Jewish point of view, the answer is clear. Sometimes, of course, obviously, the ends do justify the means. There are certain points in which you're allowed to lie and you're allowed to steal. Absolutely.
If God says it's okay.
In certain cases. Now, let me just put this in a larger context. I would say that this is a major characteristic of Jewish ethics, which that it's situational. Almost everything that's forbidden is sometimes permitted. It depends on the circumstances. There's a famous story that is true, that the famous philosopher and ethicist Immanuel Kant wrote that if you are harboring a fugitive, someone who hasn't committed any crime, but someone is pursuing him to kill him for an unjustified reason, and you harbor that innocent fugitive in your home, and you get a knock at the door, and you open the door, and a bloodthirsty pirate with an axe and a knife and a gun says, I'm looking for someone to kill him. Is he here? Is he here? Well, Kant wrote, you can't lie. Lying is forbidden. And you have to say, yeah, he's here. Now, Judaism claims that that's not the case. That just about everything which is forbidden is sometimes permitted. Can anyone give me an example of something that's usually forbidden but sometimes allowed in Judaism?
Oh, to eat it's forbidden to eat certain food. But if you have nothing else to eat,
right,
then you can eat.
Right.
Or a doctor on Shabbat,
right,
to save a life.
Exactly. Right? We say that all of the 613 mitzvot are set aside by pikuach nefesh, set aside by the possible danger to life, except for three. Except for murder and idolatry and sexual licentiousness. Besides those three, I am commanded to transgress anything in order to save human life. In other words, it's usually forbidden to transgress Shabbat, but sometimes it's a mitzvah to transgress Shabbat, and sometimes it's a mitzvah to eat unkosher food. Everything except for the three cardinal sins is forbidden, but sometimes permitted. And this is just an example of the fact that almost all of Jewish ethics is situational. There's a hierarchy of values. So sometimes, absolutely, the ends will justify the means. And it depends what the circumstances are, and it's a subject, obviously, to be studied and to know the details of. But we do not say that there are absolute categorical imperatives. That phrase categorical imperative comes from Immanuel Kant, who tried to set up a system of ethics that was absolute. Because Judaism claims there's almost no such thing as absolute ethics. Everything depends on the changing circumstances. Yeah. So, what should we do now? We can take 5 minutes to look at one of the sources in the book. It's now 10:30. Right? The next class is 10:45, right? Well, we should end on time. You know, we should end on time. That's what the rules say.
Okay.
So the books have lots and lots of sources you can look at about the burning bush. You can look at some of them. And next week we'll go on to the next unit. Okay.